Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Trump administration is considering a plan to eliminate the CDC's HIV prevention division. According to reports, the administration is weighing cutting the division focused on HIV prevention completely and moving its responsibilities to another department or cutting its budget by $700 million. AmitaCare CEO Doug Wirth is here and says the proposal is a cause for alarm and the ripple effects that decision could have across New York. Plus, CatsCast's latest episode goes inside the Ulster County Archives. The DVAA grants deadline for artists is approaching, and it's Moving Toward Health's Maggie Fitzpatrick's last column. We'll speak with her all coming up, but first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The White House says President Trump retains confidence in National Security Advisor Mike Waltz. This is after journalist Jeffrey Goldberg reported Waltz recently included him on a text chain on a secure message app. Goldberg says top Trump officials discussed impending U.S. military attacks on Yemen, and he says they went over specific information that could have harmed U.S. troops. Colorado Democratic Congressman Jason Crow was infuriated.
The idea that they would be talking about war plans and highly classified, very top secret information over a privately owned public system is shocking, to say the least, and put our troops at great risk.
Some Republican lawmakers have downplayed the seriousness of the incident, including Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
This was obviously a mess to add a reporter to this signal chain, and I feel confident it's not something that will happen again.
The White House press secretary claims that no classified material was sent to the text. That is not what Goldberg reported, and the White House National Security Council says those texts appear authentic. Stocks opened lower this morning after a big rally on Monday. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 70 points in early trading.
All the major stock indexes jumped on Monday on hopes President Trump's trade war will prove less damaging than feared. Trump says some countries may get a pass from his tariff threats. Detailed plans for reciprocal tariffs are set to be released next week. Home builders are warning Trump's tariffs could drive up construction costs, pushing the already high cost of new housing even higher. Stock in KB Homes fell after the builder lowered its sales forecast for the year. Gasoline prices are inching up as refineries make the switch to more expensive summer blends of gas. AAA says the average price of the pump for regular fuel is about $3.14 a gallon. That's up 6 cents from a week ago, but still cheaper than this time last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
More than 15,600 children have been killed in Gaza by Israeli airstrikes and direct fire. That's according to the latest data released by Gaza's health ministry. NPR's Aya Betrawi has more on the war's toll on Palestinian children.
Israeli airstrikes over the past week have pushed the death toll in Gaza past 50,000 people killed in the war, according to Gaza's health ministry. Israel says among those killed are also thousands of militants. But in a newly detailed list naming the dead, the health ministry notes that children alone make up 31% of all those killed by Israeli fire in Gaza. The single-spaced list naming Palestinians killed in the war runs more than 1,500 pages long. Just the first 27 pages are the names of more than 800 babies under a year old killed in Gaza. The health ministry notes nearly 34,000 other children have been wounded, many with amputations. Aya Beltraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
This is NPR. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee has a Senate confirmation hearing today. He's President Trump's nominee to be ambassador to Israel. Huckabee is a longtime supporter of Israel and a well-known evangelical Christian. He has spoken favorably of several of Israel's views. One of them includes the potential Israeli annexation of Palestinian territory. That would contradict long-standing U.S. policy and would be opposed by other nations. Telehealth employees at the Department of Veterans Affairs are being summoned back into the office to work. Clinicians say this change in policy could compromise care for veterans. NPR's Katie Riddle has more.
Doctors and therapists say there is just not enough space at VA facilities for them to work. Many were hired as telehealth employees. Now, many will still be doing telehealth, but from one shared space. H is one such provider. She has to be identified by only her initial for fear of losing her job. She says this arrangement could violate health privacy laws.
It is very unclear how we could continue to deliver treatment because multiple people cannot be in one office trying to do treatment all at the same time.
The VA said in a response that these concerns were, quote, nonsensical and promised to continue care for veterans. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
In South Korea, multiple wildfires continue to burn in southern provinces. Cultural buildings are under threat. A Buddhist temple that is more than 1,000 years old has burned down. Treasures inside the temple were relocated ahead of the flames. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Since 1981, HIV has led to the deaths of more than 700,000 people in the United States. More than 1.2 million Americans now live with HIV, according to federal statistics. About 13% of people who have HIV don't even know they have it. That's one driver of the virus's continuing spread. Ending AIDS in the United States was, by 2030, was one of President Donald Trump's stated priorities in his 2019 State of the Union speech. But the second Trump administration has hinted that it will make major cuts to HIV-related projects. The administration is considering a plan to eliminate the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's division focused on HIV prevention and potentially move its responsibilities over to another department within the Department of Health and Human Services, as first reported in the Wall Street Journal. The plan to eliminate the CDC's division on HIV prevention is still in the, quote, very, very preliminary stages, end quote, a source familiar with the plans told NBC News, and no final call has been made yet. The NIH has eliminated funding for dozens of HIV-related research grants, according to a U.S. Department of Health and Human Services database that was updated last week, halting studies and threatening patient care across the country. Several researchers said the cuts put a stop to the hopes of ending HIV in the U.S. and around the world. More than 100 lawmakers in the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate are calling on the administration to maintain federal HIV/AIDS services, including New York Democratic Senators Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, and Republican Congressman Mike Lawler of New York's 17th District. These reports have also sparked widespread concern among public health experts and advocacy groups. Doug Wirth is the CEO of Amida Care, a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing health care services to people living with HIV. He warns of the severe consequences it could have for both prevention efforts and the communities most at risk. And Doug Wirth joins us now. Doug, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And this Trump administration report, the consideration of eliminating the CDC's division of HIV prevention, as a leading expert in this area of HIV care, what was your immediate reaction to this news?
I mean, cutting funding for the CDC's division of HIV prevention is short-sighted and it's really dangerous. It would strip away the very infrastructure that has saved lives and prevented countless new HIV infections. In fact, if these cuts move forward, we're going to see a national surge in new HIV transmissions and AIDS-related deaths, basically undoing decades of hard-won progress in communities like ours.
And how would the potential dismantling or restructuring of the CDC's HIV prevention division impact the work that you do, especially reaching at-risk populations?
Well, you know, the HIV Prevention Bureau funds about $83 million to New York State to support access to HIV prevention medications like PrEP and PEP. It funds HIV education, testing, outreach, and local program funding. We've actually seen some of the highest rates of new HIV infections in New York State, in Rockland, Broome, Orange, Columbia, Sullivan, and Dutchess counties. And a lot of that new transmission is tied to elevated rates of poverty and drug use.
And there's speculation, as I mentioned, that the CDC's HIV prevention responsibilities might be shifted to another department. What do you think are the risks of shifting that work away from the CDC, especially considering the agency's long history and expertise in tackling HIV?
I mean, the quintessential effort by the CDC to create its own division of HIV prevention, very similar to New York State's Health Department in creating an AIDS Institute. The focus on HIV prevention and treatment is what matters. And, you know, the truth is we can't abandon the call now to end the HIV epidemic. And ultimately, it will require leadership from both sides of the aisle to end the HIV epidemic in the country once and for all, and in New York specifically.
There are some folks who have been quoted as saying people will die based on these decisions that the Trump administration is considering and some of the cuts that they've already made, including the reports of NIH eliminating funding for dozens of HIV-related research grants, the money that they've already rescinded from USAID, funding for worldwide prevention efforts. The administration claims there are financial implications. What do you think about the argument that this helps save money?
Well, I think that is completely ridiculous. By investing in prevention, helping people to get primary care visits, sexual health services, getting on PrEP, which is a proven prevention medication to prevent HIV transmission, all of those tools have been shown to work. And as you mentioned, President Trump pledged to end the HIV epidemic in the U.S. in 2019, and now that promise is being broken. New people, new Americans, will contract HIV. It's completely preventable, and the lifetime cost of treating HIV disease, depending on where you live in the country, could be anywhere from $350,000 to $500,000. We can prevent the cost of treatment by preventing new transmissions, helping people to be well, and get a bit about the business of living their lives, going to school, getting jobs, and contributing ultimately to our economy and to the health and well-being of our country.
The administration says that in an executive order that the government spends too much money on, quote, programs, contracts, and grants that do not promote the interests of the American people, end quote, and directs all agency heads to let the public know the details of, quote, every terminated program, canceled contract, terminated grant, or any other discontinued obligation of federal funds, end quote. It just seems contradictory to the idea that we're talking about here, that it does promote the interests of the American people by eliminating a chronic illness or spending money to research it and to end it.
Yeah, I mean, HIV has been a public health problem for decades. We're on the verge of ending the epidemic, but if prevention funding is cut, we're just going to end up spending more money for care and treatment later on. We can, in fact, end the HIV epidemic. We have the tools. Now is not a time to cut Medicaid, to cut HIV funding, and walk away. This is precisely the wrong moment and the wrong answer.
I mentioned in the introduction that more than 100 lawmakers have called on the administration to maintain these federal HIV/AIDS services, including the Republican Congressman Mike Lawler of New York's 17th District here in the Hudson Valley. Do you think that this bipartisan effort will yield a change in these proposals or these ideas that the administration is considering?
It's absolutely Congress's responsibility to stand up and speak out on these issues. Lawler's district actually experienced some of the highest rates of new HIV diagnoses in all of New York State, according to recent state data. I thank him for his advocacy and ask him to continue to stand up for the care and treatment of all New Yorkers.
What would you like to see from policymakers and the administration to ensure that there's this progress that continues against the HIV epidemic?
Well, we don't need to dismantle HIV prevention or defund it. We need to continue moving forward. We actually are on the cusp of having new medication, PrEP, that is subcutaneous. Right now, you can get a HIV prevention medication, a shot, which is actually intramuscular in the butt. It's painful, it's difficult, and not enough people are using it. But we're on the cusp of actually having a PrEP injection that could be in your arm twice a year and to prevent HIV disease and transmission. Now is not the time to back off. We call on the president to honor his commitment and his pledge from 2019, not to break it, and to continue the progress we're making to ending the HIV epidemic in the U.S. We can lead the country in ending the HIV epidemic here first.
How can folks learn more, get involved, help, you know, maintain these programs and this funding?
It's really important for listeners in your area to contact congressional leaders. New York 17, 18, and 19 congressional districts in particular, to make the voice of the people heard with our congressional leaders. Ask them to stand up and protect HIV funding. The proposed cuts are a dangerous step back, short-sighted and dangerous. Ask our elected officials to stand with the people and help end the HIV epidemic here in New York.
And finally, before we go, are you concerned that some of this, some of these proposals, some of what we've heard, some of the reporting when it comes to cost cutting in the federal government is being driven by numbers, that not people that necessarily understand the science or the healthcare impacts in this case?
Well, you know, the proposed CDC cuts are a part of a broader attack on public health. If you think about public health, that's we the people, the American people. We've talked before about the way that Medicaid provides the largest source of health coverage for people living with low incomes, for people living with chronic conditions like HIV and behavioral health conditions. The impact will be on low-income people, people who work in small businesses with lower wages, who don't have employer-sponsored health insurance. I mean, cutting Medicaid, cutting HIV prevention is going to make it harder for those Americans in the most need from accessing care. And when people don't access care, you see a skyrocket in hospital costs and long-term care costs. It's very simple. You can spend much fewer money on primary care and outpatient services, helping people to be well so that they can go to school, go to work, or take care of their family. This is about taking care of Americans. This is not about giving away money to the wealthiest Americans at the expense of working people and people with smaller incomes.
That's Doug Wirth, CEO of AmidaCare. AmidaCare is a private nonprofit community health plan that specializes in providing comprehensive health coverage and coordinated care to Medicaid members with chronic conditions, including HIV/AIDS and behavioral health disorders. There's more information at AmidaCareNY.org. Doug Wirth, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Tim, and thanks to the listeners for calling their congressional leaders.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the latest episode of Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's nearly time to blast off with the Retro Cocktail Hour. Daryl Brogdon here inviting you to drop in at the Underground Martini Bunker for classic tiki tunes, private eye jazz, swinging movie music, and other stereo overstimulation. The Retro Cocktail Hour.
Wednesday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Forget the seatbelts. Fire up the cocktail shaker.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, CatsCast is the Catskills podcast, and host producer Brett Berry is taking us inside the Ulster County Archives on this episode. Brett is joining us now. Brett, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Tim?
I'm good. I didn't realize, I don't know why I didn't think about this, but when you send us the recording, the report from your podcast that we're going to hear in a few minutes, you also send a few photos, and the photos on this one are from inside the Ulster County Archives. It looks huge.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's very impressive standing there and looking up at these tens of thousands of boxes and rows of them. In various stages of storage. So, I spoke with the archivist there who said the perception is that we hold on to everything forever because we're the archives, but that's not true. Everything has a timeline. So some things are held onto forever, but other things require 30 days or 60 days or a year or whatever the case may be, depending on how long it's expected that those documents might be needed.
What kinds of documents and items are in the archives that they're holding onto?
So a lot of the papers from the county clerk's office, court records, municipal records, things that may not seem too exciting, but very important. And then also deeper archives of records that go back to the 17th century, which is pretty incredible. So In the follow-up interview, which we won't hear this morning, but it is available on the podcast because we have limited time this morning, but we did take a tour of the archives, and they showed us some of those materials, including an original treaty between the Esopus and the British, which is there in a box available for people to study, which is one of the many treasures that are in that kind of deeper archive.
That's kind of cool and also exciting. And somebody that's excited about this is the Ulster County historian, Eddie Moran, that you spoke to. That's what we're going to hear in this clip.
Yeah, so Eddie Moran is the brand new Ulster County historian. He's young. He's a New Paltz graduate, worked at Historic Huguenot Street for a number of years, and then was recently hired as the county historian. So really great. Great guy. It was really nice to sit down with him and hear his thoughts about taking the reins over there.
All right, let's go inside the Ulster County Archives. It's the latest episode of Cats Cast from Brett Berry. Brett, thanks.
Thank you, Tim.
Edward Moran III, he goes by Eddie, is a descendant of the region's Huguenot and Dutch colonists. And as Ulster County's newly appointed historian, he's well aware that history doesn't stop there. I joined Eddie for a conversation at the Ulster County Hall of Records in Kingston, New York.
My name is Eddie Moran. I'm the newly appointed Ulster County historian. So municipal historians are actually a state-mandated position. Every town, really every village, every county is required by law to have a historian.
So I think a lot of people associate the role of a historian with, let's say, a gray-haired individual.
Yeah.
Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 26.
What has drawn you to history?
You know, it's a question I can answer in a bunch of ways, I think. And honestly, I think that's a question that I think over my own head still all the time. And I sometimes come to different answers. But, you know, as far as I can remember, I've always been interested in history in general. It kind of strikes an interest that also, you know, arises in other areas like nature and the environment, of just why questions, of wanting to understand kind of how things work and how things came to be the way they are now. And I think that growing up in Ulster County, I grew up in the kind of area around New Paltz, the Wallkill River Valley. You grow up really with a sense of histories all around you.
What do you think a young historian brings to the table?
That's a fantastic question. I mean, in one sense, I think energy and, you know, a commitment to this role that I think lends itself to long-term goals and to, you know, projects that take a great deal of time. I think there's maybe a parallel to be had even with the type of training you get as a doctoral student in history, where your first years or a large portion of your first years are just getting familiar with the scholarship that has already been done on your chosen research topic. And that was something I had to do at Huguenot Street in my first months, was familiarize myself with all that had already been written about local history of the period that they interpreted there. And so there's a degree of that. People are really starting to revisit traditional narratives and interpretations of history. And, you know, sometimes I shy away from the word revise so much as I like to say they are completing them, because I think people are very comfortable, and, you know, we know as a field, really, that a lot of the history that had previously been done was not complete.
So you bring up an interesting point here, and your bio describes you as a descendant of Huguenot and Dutch settlers. How does that ancestry inform how you interpret and disseminate Ulster County history?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that my own upbringing really is a good example of the way that history used to previously be incomplete. So as I was growing up, you know, thankfully, in the state curriculum here, students are required to learn about local history. But still, you know, when I think back to the elementary school lessons I had on indigenous people, what I recall is lessons about the Haudenosaunee, and they're very present in my mind. And I can't readily recall learning about the people that lived here, an entirely different cultural group whose language, the Lenape, is as far from Haudenosaunee as it is from English. And so that, I think, you know, gives you one sense of that way it's incomplete. But I also grew up going on field trips to places like historic Huguenot Street. I was blessed to have parents that also really encouraged this love of history and would take me on weekends to local historic sites. And I have family that are also interested in history. I have an uncle who's a social studies teacher. You know, I was quite young when he first told me that the history I was hearing at historic Huguenot Street was not complete. At a time when there were staff members and researchers there who were uncovering and were starting to promote more inclusive and accurate history there, but it still hadn't kind of permeated the full organization and story. You know, my own upbringing and that ancestry gives me, I think, almost a sense of responsibility. The descendants of the Lenape people today, their nations, their governments, reside today in Ontario, Oklahoma, and Wisconsin. I'm descended of the colonizers that took that land from them. And here I sit in Kingston, New York, the same place where they took that land some 300-400 years ago. The story of my ancestors has always been told. Doesn't everybody deserve that same right?
How are you working with other local organizations and entities to broaden our collective perspective of history?
Yeah, in one sense, just giving them time and resources, even just one person full-time being dedicated to research, is more than many local historical societies can say they have. They're really built, many of them, on just dedicated volunteers who are, you know, generously lending their own time to this work. And so, you know, one example is I'm working right now with the Ulster County Historical Society in Marbletown. And with their, you know, incredible support, I've been documenting references to enslaved and native people in the account books of the head of household in the house that now comprises the County Historical Society. I have time here each day in my job to be doing research like that, to then plan a talk or a presentation, give that to them. But also, you know, I work with other organizations in a more advisory capacity as well. And sometimes it's a matter of tying them all together. The account books are preserved in a different repository. They are preserved and held at historic Huguenot Street, but they were created and they're relevant to the history of a different museum, the Ulster County Historical Society. And so sometimes, you know, some of my work is also bringing those organizations together, cultivating a network of historians here that can support one another too.
Let's backtrack a little bit. What are the roles of a county historian? I know there's quite a few.
That's a great question. You know, one of the roles is to just continuously research and promote and share the history of the county, to be doing research from primary sources, both here but also held in other repositories, and to do research, talks, to bring that information to the public. I mentioned another responsibility, which is cultivating and supporting a network of local historians. Sometimes I kind of refer to it as like history infrastructure around the county. But it's also providing research help to the public as well. You know, sometimes that can be a doctoral student or a professor at a university who's working on a specific research topic relevant to our area. And sometimes, and I think one of the most rewarding instances are, you know, the smaller questions that an individual might have about their own ancestry. Someone who might have been raised in Kingston or had a family member who lived here that they visited a few times as a kid. Can you help me find out who my grandfather that lived in Kingston was? Can you help me find out more about him and more about his life? And, you know, truth be told, that oftentimes is way quicker than a lot of the research I'm doing on my own. And yet it has an immediate and I think a really outsized impact.
And you can just do that. That's part of your job.
Yeah,
and I can, anyone in the public could call and
absolutely
ask you for this research.
Absolutely. And with the huge amount of emails and requests we get, sometimes it can take us a week or two to get back to you. But yeah, we're here and we will help you.
If I wanted to know a little bit more about the history of the property that my house is on, is that something that you would be able to help me with?
Absolutely. And that especially is, you know, almost kind of similar to some of the work that's done when you buy a new house. It's title searches. It's, you know, creating a chain of deeds going back to the earliest landowner. But then we also can help with things like newspaper references. Our archivist, John Palmer, also has, for those moments when we're facilitating research, for example, he has a guide that he created that is how to research your house history. And so sometimes we have formal guides we can provide. Sometimes it's me, you know, kind of less formally talking with someone, meeting with someone to talk them through how they would do that research.
Great. I would love to schedule some time with you guys.
Absolutely.
To figure that out. What's your sense at this point of the breadth of these archives?
It's a bit daunting, you know, truth be told. And, you know, thankfully, none of the records are really out of reach. And that's something that I think we are really striving now to make clear to people, is that, you know, John is doing incredible work with our archives division in digitizing records and making them fully available. I'm working actively in doing research to bring the information from these records to the public. But that said, anyone is also free to make an appointment with John to come and to look at those records themselves. And even if, you know, we haven't gotten to digitizing a record, one example that I can shout out right away that's deeply important are the records from the Ulster County Poorhouse, which was in New Paltz in the 20th century. That was a place where, you know, not only people that were in poverty, but you know, people on the margins of society who were oftentimes cast aside, many people that were cast aside and on the margins found themselves there. People passed away there, or if they passed away elsewhere and were cast aside, they were buried there. We do have an interpretive publication exhibit online about that history. We are working in the next few years to digitize those records. We also, you know, encourage and invite anyone from the public who wants to see those records, to do that research, to reach out to us, you know, as soon as possible to come and to view those originals too.
Materials that are online, how do people access that?
Both our kind of digitized archives, the digital records themselves that are scanned, as well as the archives of a number of incredible local museums and organizations. So SUNY New Paltz, towns like New Paltz, the Ulster County Historical Society, and I could go on, all use this same platform, which is nyheritage.org. And you can navigate that platform by, you know, you can do it geographically. You can navigate it by a list of organizations. It's incredible.
As a newbie in this role, do you have a list of priorities?
Yeah. You know, I think that there's a responsibility to not just tell an accurate and inclusive story of Native history, but I think there is a responsibility to, you know, begin engaging, supporting, and, you know, like fully incorporating the perspectives of the descendants of those Native people. And so, you know, it's a story that we're proud to be delving into and that we're proud to be expanding the narrative to include a better idea of what the Native experience here was, of just how devastating colonization in this area was. But it's a story that I think is not necessarily best told by me. They are the best keepers of that knowledge. And, you know, no one can better share their perspectives than they themselves. You know, they live in these, to a degree, faraway places. As a result of the actions of the colonists who created the government that I work for. And so I think there's a responsibility to not just tell that story accurately, but to do a better job in supporting those individuals and facilitating their access to the land where that history took place and to the remnants of that material history here. So that's a goal. And expanding the narrative out to include all peoples. Yeah, so those are two of the many goals I can shout out right away, yeah.
We talked about gray-haired historians at the beginning of this conversation. This seems like a job you can gray into. Can you see yourself in this position for a while?
Absolutely. I almost kind of laugh because my 19-year-old self would probably be horrified hearing me say that. And this was not something that I saw myself researching or working in until really pretty recently, until right before I started at Huguenot Street. And so I studied history. I was very interested in the 1960s and the New Left movement in the U.S. I studied Irish history, especially 20th century Irish history. And those were histories that I think gave me a sense of, you know, not just that telling those stories was impactful and relevant to today and to improving the world that we live in, but they were stories of people that they themselves were being impacted by changing worlds and that they were trying to fight against those negative changes and to better the world that they were living in. And I didn't see a sense of that so much with local history. I still didn't have a sense of the scale of something like enslavement here, or just, you know, how rich and fascinating and important Native history here is. And it wasn't until I mentioned, you know, earlier scholars at places like Huguenot Street started to bring that history to the forefront. And so I worked there as a tour guide at a time when my predecessor, she was beginning to work in that research from those early scholars into the interpretation. And immediately I saw, oh, wait. This history that I had discounted and kind of wrote off my whole life, this local history, this is a place where, you know, I can't think of a history where there's more important work to be done in expanding the narrative and where there's more of an impact to be had.
So the limited scope you were exposed to as a younger person was what kind of drove you away from being so interested in local history, but then realizing that it goes a lot deeper?
I really appreciate that question, because I may have even been kind of simplifying the issue a bit through this conversation. I keep referring to, you know, expanding the narrative, or, you know, you just rephrase that so well as, you know, kind of a narrower scope. And that is part of it. It's just, you know, people weren't endeavoring to even try and tell the stories of marginalized peoples. But I also would say that even the discriminatory history being done wasn't accurate. And I find that that's really important, because we're not trying to tear down one group to bring someone else up. The story that was being told, which included that one group, was not accurate across the board. In certain areas, it was not accurate because it didn't even endeavor to include groups of people that were here. But even the history that was being done just about the Europeans, which was incredibly selective, wasn't being done accurately. And so I think it's really a matter of trying to tell a more accurate story across the board for all these groups of people.
So are your parents very proud that their son is now the Ulster County historian?
I hope so, yeah. I think so for sure. You know, Like I said, I'm blessed to grow up in a family that are very interested in history, and a family that, you know, I think cares a lot about two things that can maybe be taken for granted in a time like 2025, and that's just continued learning. I grew up in a family of people that love to learn and continue to love to learn right through the end of their lives. And so I think that's one big part of it. And I think the other part is, you know, a sense of wanting to leave the world better than when you came into it. And so, you know, I like to think I'm working towards those goals and making them proud. I know at least that I'm also having an impact too, because whether you actually have, like, you know, familiar, like, blood descendancy genealogy going back to these earlier figures from our history, we all have social descendancy, I think. You know, we all kind of inherit the legacy of the people that lived here and created the communities we live in now. And so I think that, you know, there's a sense that we should all want that to be the kind of best, most accurate and inclusive narrative possible. So, yeah, I like to think I'm kind of trying to make everybody proud.
From the Ulster County Archives in Kingston, New York, this is Brett Berry for Radio Catskill.
And you can hear the rest of Brett's episode of Cats Cast at the website. It's catscast.com, and that's KAATSCAST.com. We'll take a break, and when we come back, moving toward health with Maggie Fitzpatrick. It's the last column she's writing and sharing with us, but we've got some good news, too. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on This American Life, we present the Museum of Now, filled with artifacts of this particular moment our country is living through. Like, for instance, the transcript of a judge who's questioning an executive order that seems to be based on statements that are completely untrue, or a piece of a street near the White House that construction workers are tearing up because it had been painted with the words Black Lives Matter.
It's a huge piece. Okay, I'll take this.
That's this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, every Tuesday we've been joined by Maggie Fitzpatrick, the columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat, who writes a health and wellness column called Moving Toward Health. And this is the last Moving Toward Health column that you're going to be sharing with us, the last one you're writing for the Democrat. What's happening? You're no longer moving toward health? You moved?
It kind of hit me for the first time when you said that on air. No, of course, I will continue to be moving toward health forever for the rest of my life.
Yeah, but this is the last. You're ceasing your column, but you're going to continue with your health and wellness.
Yes. So the column is ending today. Oh. This is the last article that I will be writing for the Democrat in this capacity. Who knows what the future holds? But for now, this is the end of moving toward health. And it was challenging to come to that conclusion, but I feel like it's time for an evolution for me.
You, in your column, talk about the amount of time you've done this, over 143 weeks, sharing all kinds of great information and knowledge on health. Covering everything from physical fitness to emotional well-being. What do you think was the most rewarding part of this journey for you?
Ooh, that's a really great question. I think a couple things. One is I love reflection. We've talked about this so many times and how important it is to sit and, you know, think about what has happened and how that impacts moving forward. And for me, I think that has been one of the most rewarding things is being able to sit and think about what has happened in the last week that I can tie into a teaching point and being able to share stories from my real life and turn them into stories that can help impact someone else, find little moments of health in their day. I think that has been one of the most impactful things. And then similarly to that, being able to share it here and go deeper into the column because, you know, 500 words is not that many. So being able to share more of them on this platform has been really rewarding too.
And you, in your column, you talk about what is shaping your thinking, and those have been triumphs, those have been challenges. Has there been any particular area, these highs and lows that have helped to, you know, sort of shape your attitudes here in terms of your journey?
For sure. I think it's really easy to talk about the good times and talk about the wins, right? Of course. But the challenges are, I think, the things that build the most character and also give you the most to share when you're through them, right? It's hard to talk about things when you're in the middle of it. But once you're on the other side a little bit, it's really powerful to share and be able to show other people that they're not alone in going through something as well. And so I think the challenges have been the most impactful in terms of navigating what comes next.
What I love about your columns and about talking with you about the column is how honest you are about this approach to health and wellness. And it's not a magic bullet. There's not a secret ingredient that you can put into your, you know, morning coffee. It takes work. But your approach has always been very positive and understanding of just the unpredictability of everybody's life or life in general. And so that's been refreshing because I think for someone like me who's still challenged health, I have not moved toward health yet.
You have.
I'm moving slowly. But you approach it in a very realistic way. And I think that's what people appreciate.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
So let's remind folks, if they're still trying to, you know, prioritize health in their life, what are some little pieces of advice you can give folks again to, you know, make that a priority?
Yeah. So Moving toward health, the whole reason why I called the column that name is because it is a process that we have to be actively working on, right? And so my biggest, I guess, piece of advice that I want to leave you with of moving toward health is that it's not about being perfect. It's about taking a little bit of action every day, right? And it's not about these big, grandiose pieces of movement. It's about the little ones, right? It's about taking that little walk outside or drinking one extra glass of water or eating one more piece of broccoli, you know? It's about the little things that add up. That's when we're going to start to see the results, and remembering that even though it can feel overwhelming, breaking it down into small steps is how we're going to be successful.
And you've created a connection with people through your articles and through being here on Radio Chatskill. How do you feel the way your work has impacted readers and listeners?
Well, I hope that it has been impactful. I really, really hope that. I hope that you have been able to see that, like I said before, you're not alone, right? Moving toward health is challenging and doable, and that your mindset and your approach towards it is what makes all of the difference. Because we can all sit here and say, you know, why me, poor me, that type of thing, have that type of mindset, but that's not going to get us closer to what we really want. So I hope that one of my biggest impacts has been for you to be able to see that you have a lot more control over it than you think.
And the good news that I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation is that we're going to continue talking with you, because you may be ending this column, but maybe unbeknownst to some listeners, you have all these other things going on as well. Tell us about the podcast that you have and how we are going to hear more about that soon.
Yeah, I'm so excited to share more about that here. I love coming here and talking with you. So I'm really excited to be able to continue to do that. One of my best friends, Megan Spencer, formerly Ross, she's from Liberty. She's from the area, just like me. We started a podcast together back in 2021, and it's called You Can Trust Yourself. And every week we share episodes on different topics, tying it all back to learning how to trust yourself, trust your instincts, trust your intuition, and really quiet the noise of what's going on in the outside world, especially in times like right now where everything outside of us is really overwhelming. It can be really challenging to know if the decisions that we're making are based off of what's best for us or if they're based off of noise from other people. And we really guide you through that.
I like what you say in your podcast in the about section that it is difficult to trust ourselves, and that your mission is to leave you with encouragement and tools to nurture your ability to do just that, to trust yourself. And so there is this connection to health and wellness in the podcast as well. So you're not abandoning your health journey or ours. You're continuing it and also embracing it in a larger, broader aspect, I think.
Exactly. That's really the goal, and the picture here is to just expand and encompass all of the other things that I do and frankly that I'm good at into what I'm sharing outside of just health and wellness. Because one of my big, most favorite things to talk about is how we can optimize our human performance, right? What does that mean? Well, health and wellness are one part of that. Trusting yourself is one part of that, right? And how do we live a life that we're proud of? How do we show up as our best self every day? Well, these are all components of that. And I'm really excited to be able to share more than just the physical nature of it.
And some of the latest episodes that you have shared with Meg are including the journey toward authenticity, navigating the pressure to perform versus just being yourself, embracing mindful consumption. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. And being intentional with your favorite things, not overdoing it. Even touching on religion and politics, trusting yourselves to go deeper with people who believe in different things. So a wide range of topics that you guys are covering. And we should mention Megan is a clinical mental health counselor in training, specializes in working with women through a personal-centered approach. And you, of course, are specializing in optimizing mental and physical human performance. So this seems like a good combination, and we're looking forward to having you back and Meg too to talk about it. We're going to pause and do this after the fun drive, because if you haven't heard, the fun drive starts on Monday and goes through April 11th. So we'll see you in April then with Meg, and we'll talk more about You Can Trust Yourself with Meg and Maggie, your podcast. So we're excited that you're going to be continuing this journey with us. in a slightly different way. Readers of the Democrat, please continue to listen here, and we'll keep talking to Coach Maggie. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to come back.
And the last column for the Democrat, the Moving Toward Health column, is out now on newsstands or at scdemocratonline.com. All right, we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yes, see you soon.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, what's happening at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance this weekend and a deadline for grants for artists is coming up very soon. We'll get more from Tanner Simon from the DVAA after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
The NPR network informs and connects communities around the country, providing reliable information in times of crisis. Your support helps ensure that public radio remains freely available to everyone. Please make your gift to this station today. Here's how, and thank you.
Make your donation at wjffradio.org.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance has a grants deadline that's coming up, and they have a couple of performances coming up this weekend. To learn more about it, we're going to talk to Tanner Simon, who's the gallery and grants manager at DVAA. Good morning, Tanner.
Why, hi, good morning, Tim. Thank you for having me on the show, and thank you for the nice introduction there. You saved me saying it all.
A little bit. We've talked about this grant that is for artists previously, but this deadline for the artists to apply is coming up soon. When is that? This week?
So it's next Monday, March 31st at midnight. And this grant is for artists with a fiscal sponsor or nonprofit organization. So the fellowship deadline happened. And for those of you who don't know, next year you can apply for a $3,000 individual artist grant. This time around, the funding is for public programming for the arts or cultural events. So, you know, we're talking about music performances, theater performances, some kind of poetry readings, artist talks, anything like that. That's a public event put on by a nonprofit organization. Maybe you're a library or, you know, otherwise a community group. You don't have to be an art group. It's just about the programming, the art programming.
And remind folks again the amount that's available.
So the amount, the minimum is $500, and the maximum is $2,500, which is actually $500 higher than last year. So we're giving out more money this time. And we already have, you know, people applying, and there's a lot of interest in it, and we have about a week left.
All right.
So it's really the key time to give me a call or give me an email, and I'll happily talk through the guidelines with you, and it's really straightforward. It's very similar to our other funding, except instead of being funded by the state, this is coming straight from the Sullivan County Legislature. So it's a very big honor that we get to distribute this money from the county for the county.
And there's more information again at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org, and that deadline is coming up on Monday. Now, you've got a couple of things coming up this weekend. What's going on at DVAA coming up?
Yeah, so this Saturday at 5 p.m., the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance is hosting two performances by local artists as a closing for our annual member show, Assembly Required. So that show was highlighting artistic collaborations between multiple artists and, you know, the struggle, the wonders that occur. Some of these collaborations were already happening. Some of them we put people together just for the show, or they came together on their own. You know, it was very interesting. So G.H. and Raphael Shirley are performing at 5:30, and G.H. is doing some music on the guitar. He's going to rock your socks off, and Raphael Shirley has a light installation. And then right before that, we're opening with Dale Emmert and Glenn Lieberman, who are married, and this is their first collaboration was for this show. So Glenn's a composer, Dale is a painter, a drawer. She's been making books. So she made a book on composition paper, on Glenn's composition paper for music, and then he made a piece that goes along with the book. So they're doing like a public reading, and it's very exciting because they've been married for so long. They've never merged their artistic practices like that.
And
so
then
we're very excited.
So that those performances happening this weekend, and you guys aren't closing down. You turn right around, and then you've got two more things coming up the following weekend, April 5th. There's a Salon Series event, and then also another reception opening.
Yeah, that's correct. So this is the closing. Then I have a week with, hopefully I'll have some good volunteers helping me out. We'll be repainting the gallery walls, taking down the artwork, packing it up, and then in-house we'll be making the programs and installing the shows. Yeah, it's a very tight turnaround because I don't start work until Tuesday. And then, the opening's on Saturday.
I'm glad you get some time off. That's
Yeah. So, well, a couple days. We're busy.
Yeah. So let's talk about the two events that are coming up on the 5th. It's About Time with Eric Balin is in the Salon Series. And then the opening reception there in the gallery, Jenny Carpenter and Kelly O'Brien.
Yeah, exactly. So the Salon Series event, I don't have my paper. But yeah, so we have the piano out. Kazuray Jackson's coming back on.
Kevin Scott Graham, Matt Carpenter, they're going to mark the start of National Poetry Month with this poetry happening, as you call it, presented by Eric Balin. And then that opening reception, as we mentioned, Jenny Carpenter, Kelly O'Brien is later at 4. And we'll talk to them about it, too. But this is the Open Spaces exhibit from Jenny Carpenter and then Kelly O'Brien's When We Are Among the Trees. I hope I said that right.
Exactly. And so very interesting work, both working referencing nature. So we have like this organic landscape that, inorganic landscape that Kelly O'Brien's making, some plastic things referencing trees, these columns that come down from the ceiling. Then we have Jenny, who's working on wooden panel and kind of utilizing the natural wood grain to make these paintings out of it. So it's very interesting work, and I believe they both are coming on the radio too, so I'm excited to hear them, their passion for the work. And it's going to be a really, really intense day for sure.
All right,
we're
looking forward to more art happenings, as we always do with the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. And again, a reminder for artists and nonprofits to learn more and get that grant application in by Monday, right?
Yep, that's right. Monday at midnight. So don't wait. And please do call me, reach out, because I'd love to talk through the project with you. If it's your first time applying, I'm here to help. So
that's great. Tanner Simon is the gallery and grants manager for the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. You can reach him at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. Tanner, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
You're welcome. Thank you. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. And as we mentioned with Coach Maggie earlier, our fun drive is starting officially on Monday as well. It's our spring fun drive. And we need your help to face some of the challenges you may have heard about in public media. Your donations will help ensure that our voice continues to thrive and remains here on the air as we have been for the last 35 years. It's our 35th anniversary. Help us reach our fund drive goal of donate early and make your donation at wjffradio.org. And thank you for your support, and thank you for listening. I'm Tim Bruno. See you tomorrow.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, the unknown history of the iconic little black dress.
Something about dressing rich, mostly white women is uncomfortable, especially while you're wearing the little black dress, your work uniform. You begin to wonder, why do I look like I'm her maid?
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather about the same as yesterday, mostly cloudy, high 44, some winds up to 20 miles an hour. Cloudy tonight, low 25, and then tomorrow, not as warm, a few flurries or snow showers possible as well, high of 38. On Point is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.